Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Looks like you need a vacation. Enter the 5-Hour Energy Where Will the Tide Take You sweepstakes. You could win a $10,000 dream beach vacation. Imagine jet setting off to a tropical paradise, having fun in the sun, or diving at a gorgeous reef. It's up to you. No purchase necessary. Go to 5hetide.com for official rules and to enter. That's 5hetide.com. Enter today. Ends June 30th, 2024.
The old world is dying. The new world struggles to be born. Now is the time of monsters. With those words from Gramsci, I welcome you to the Time of Monsters podcast, sponsored by The Nation magazine. This podcast appears weekly and is available on all major podcast platforms. The American film director Martin Scorsese, perhaps the greatest American filmmaker ever, has always given us an amazing array of monstrous figures in his films. One can think of Travis Bickle in Taxi Driver, who goes on a horrific murderous killing spree. The Jimmy Doyle in New York, New York, kind of, clingy, manic musician who tries to sabotage his wife's success. Jake LaMotta in Raging Bull, like a brutal boxer who also inflicts pain, not just on his opponents in the ring, but on his loved ones, including his first wife. And I think to this array of monsters, we now have a new members of the pantheon who have some similarities with what's gone before, but also maybe are sort of like bring Scorsese's characteristic themes to like a new level of intensity. The new movie, of course, as everyone knows, is The Killers of the Flower Moon. It's set in the 1920s in Oklahoma, in Osage County, and it features Robert De Niro, longtime Scorsese collaborator, as William King Hale, a wealthy rancher, and Leonardo DiCaprio as Ernst Burkhardt, his nephew. And this is based on a true story. And what these men did, this is not a spoiler alert because it's pretty clear early in the movie, but what they did is kind of monstrous, which is going on a murder spree against Native Americans, particularly Native American women of the Osage Nation, in order to get their oil land. And then using the instrument of marriage as the way to do this, to marry into these families and then kill spouses to enrich their own white family. It's a kind of an amazing story, both on its own, but it's also, a sort of, as I said, a culmination, or it seems to be, Scorsese really bringing together obsessive themes that he's had throughout all his long, distinguished career and really bringing them together. So to talk about this, what I think is a remarkable movie, I'm very happy to have on David Kleon, the frequent guest of the podcast, a frequent contributor to The Nation, The New Republic, Jewish Currents, and many other publications that are lucky to have him. So David, do you want to introduce yourself and let's talk about the movie?
Yeah, so I just reviewed this for The New Republic, where I generally put my film and TV criticism. And I'm reading the book now. I've mostly read the book before we do this.
Yeah, I should mention it's based on a nonfiction book by David Gran, a New Yorker staff writer. And it was a huge bestselling book and is very well regarded.
Yes, yeah. The book came out in 2017. I actually went to an event at the New York Public Library at the time and then just didn't get around to reading it, but in which Gran was being interviewed by a perfect interlocutor, Jeffrey Toobin. And it was a packed event, and the really striking thing actually was during the Q&A, a living member of the Osage Nation stood up and praised Gran for the book and for calling attention to these mm-hmm. stories, which, the Osage Nation had basically waited a century for. The story is completely fascinating. As I say in my review, it upends a lot of people's conventional wisdom about what the West was like, really. And I think Scorsese captures this incredibly well on camera in what I would almost describe as world building. I mean, it's a real world that he's recreating, but it's a world that we've never quite seen before in this way. So what I mean by that is, you know, in the opening shots of the movie, we see the Osage in this kind of, you know, barren prairie environment, which, as we come to learn, they were basically exiled to. In the late 19th century and into the early 20th century, what we now call Oklahoma was considered Indian territory. It was not a state. It was a kind of almost a giant reservation in the middle of the country to which Indians had been pushed from mostly the southeastern United States, you know, by Andrew Jackson's Trail of Tears and so on. The Osage had been driven there from, I think, Kansas and other states in the middle of the country and, you know, ended
up
there.
And Missouri as well, I think.
And yeah. Missouri. And they ended up in Oklahoma, this small tribe, you know, for lack of other options. And as we see in the incredible opening scene of the movie, they struck oil. And we see them, you know, a group of them basically dancing and reveling in the middle of an oil spurt, knowing their world has changed forever. Striking oil in the late 19th century was a big deal. And by the, you know, first decades of the 20th century, an enormous deal. You know, oil is just beginning to become the most valuable thing in the world, the spice melange, if you will. And, you know, it's people are just using it to light and heat their homes and obviously for cars and weapons of war and so on. And so the Osage, as we learn, you know, very quickly, very, very quickly become, by some reckonings, the wealthiest per capita group of people in the world, which, speaking for myself, before I saw Grant speak about this in 2017, I just had no idea that that was the case. I had never heard any of the story. I was, of course, aware that the history of the United States is one of, you know, nonstop injustices and massacres against Native peoples. And but the specific nature of this one, I mean, in my imagining, and I imagine to most Americans, you know, that story looks something like this. You know, white settlers come in, maybe they fight some wars with the Indians, maybe they just round them up and drive them west or herd them into reservations, maybe, you know, depending on the era, they're dying from smallpox. You know, that those are the kind of images that pop into my head when I think of the genocide. What you don't normally think of, I certainly didn't, is this oil boom town in which it's actually the Indians who have all the money and are living lavish urban lifestyles, albeit in a tiny town that still has, you know, muddy, unpaved streets, and that's just kind of sprung up out of nowhere, in which, you know, many of their domestic servants, their chauffeurs, and so on are white people who have, you know, traveled out there in search of employment. And in which the horrible process by which white people steal what's rightfully the Osage money is a creepily intimate one of, you know, marriages and kind of infiltration of their communities and, fittingly for a Scorsese movie, an almost mafia-like conspiracy to assassinate them one by one. And this is just, I mean, if this movie accomplished nothing else, I mean, the book obviously got us halfway there, but if this book and movie accomplished nothing else, they've made this incredibly chilling chapter of American history mainstream knowledge, which it truly wasn't. And but it also does a lot more than that, I would say.
Yeah. No. I there's a couple of points that you made there that I want to like hit on, which is I think in the sort of mental map that people have of American history, indigenous people sort of belong in the early part of the story. And it's the story of, you know, like Columbus and maybe the later the Indian Wars and, you know, Andrew Jackson, and then sort of drop out of history. And I think
Custer's Last Stand.
Yeah.
But not this. Yeah. I mean, they're for one thing, they're not seen as urban people living, you know, in mansions, being driven around in cars, wearing fancy clothes. That's just not the story that anyone is told about, you know, Native Americans in the early 20th century.
Yeah, I know. And so there has actually been a sort of trend among historians to sort of complicate that story in a number of different ways. One of which is to just emphasize the sort of persistence of the Native tribes. I mean, if you think about the fact that the, you know, Indian Wars were fought in the late 19th century, that basically meant that there was like a 400, the final defeat of the indigenous nations, or perhaps not even final, but like, you know, the herding into reservations. And so that's a 400-year period where, you know, these were actually like tribes that they were autonomous nations within this continent. who had land, who had cultures, who had diplomatic relationships with other nations, with the other indigenous nations, but also with the British, the French, and later, you know, the Americans. And so there's a there was a kind of monomyth that was created in the late 19th century coming out of the Indian Wars of, you know, like, as you said, you know, Custer's last stand and then the defeat of Geronimo. Well, you know, well, that chapter of history is over. And now these are like defeated people. And also like that these are people who are going to disappear. This is like actually like a conceptual, important conceptual scheme in not just the United States, but also in Canada and throughout the Western Hemisphere, that, you know, these are people who now belong to the past and are not no longer, they will be in the reservations and we'll take good care of them. We'll give them schools. Well, we all know what happened there. And we'll, you know, give them Christianity. But, you know, we're in the sort of role of caretakers who are overseeing a dying people and, you know, like giving them the, you know, like a dignified final exit. It's a kind of a euthanasia view of Native history. And so I think one thing that makes the story compelling, you know, aside from like all the obvious drama, is that it actually shows, no, they didn't disappear. They, you know, they had a robustness and persistence. And in this, the particular case, the Osage, you know, like they, you know, they precisely because they were put into the worst land, you know, that's where oil often is, right? It's like the land that no one wants has the traits that lead to oil. In some ways, they're like sort of like Saudi Arabia. So I think that, I mean, I think like Scorsese is like keying in on a very important way in which this story upends the traditional narrative of America. And I noticed in some of the ads, they say a true American story, you know, which to emphasize, you know, this is an American story and it's different. And I think your review actually, which we'll link to, like really brings this out, like the overturning of the myth. And the second point, you know, I had mentioned earlier, you know, this idea that the indigenous people are dying people, right? There's a famous phrase like the vanishing American. These are the vanishing American. They're like, you know, they're the great grandparents that were like are in retirement home and they're not going to be with us much longer. That cultural myth, that sort of, you know, self-serving fantasy, I think is very important in the movie. It actually helps us understand the dynamics between the white characters and the Osage.
Yeah, well, I mean, for one thing, Hale, the sort of ringleader of this evil plot played by De Niro, quite explicitly justifies himself according to the myth that you've laid out. I mean, this movie mostly takes place in the late 19-teens and 1920s, by which point that myth is very well established, right? The frontier has been closed, you know, the any kind of true autonomy has been defeated, and the Osage are living in, you know, a territory that white settlers are greedily staking out for themselves. And, you know, De Niro is literally plotting a mass murder and expropriation ring while, you know, posturing as a, you know, Old Testament Christian. The way he reconciles that, apparently to the end of his life, Hale did, is with this sort of narrative of the inevitability of the Indians dying out. That's what he tells his son. And the incredible and chilling thing about the character is that he's able to, in the service of this nefarious plot, so fully ingratiate himself with the Osage community to the point of learning their language. I mean, he actually learned a language spoken by, you know, a few thousand people, most of whom by this point seem to also speak English. That's the sort of degree of commitment he had. And he dubs himself, you called him King at one point. That's the name that his nephew calls him. He styles himself the King of the Osage, this white rancher who's, you know, in the process of murdering the Osage. He, you know, he's created this whole self-serving ideology that in which I think he actually believes that on some level, that he is the sort of manager of the inevitable demise of these people, and that in order to pull that off, he's going to integrate himself into their world, which is monstrously evil on a level that, I mean, obviously the white settler genocide of Native Americans is evil in every way, but rarely do we see it depicted as, you know, in this unflinching way. And then even when we do, I think that, you know, it's generally seen as like white settlers just want to take the land, take the resources, kill the Indians or drive them away. They don't want to, like, you know, intimately get to know them. You know, they don't want to, like, I mean, there's something that's so much more chilling about that in a way.
Yeah, sure. Although, I mean, that's exactly right. And although I have to say, well, there's a couple of things to say on that point. One of which is that the people who did the most harm to the Indigenous people were the ones that were most intimate with them. I mean, you know, like here in Canada, there's a big issue with the residential schools.
Right.
These were like schools administered by the Canadian state, or financed by the Canadian state, administered by churches, both Catholic and Protestant churches, that were, you know, designed to, you know, as they say, the term they used was to civilize the savage or civilize the child. And then there were sites of like horrific abuse. And one thing to think about, like, those schools is that the people who were doing them were, first of all, styling themselves as missionaries, as where they were seen as the great humanitarians of Canadian and American society, the people who were going to live among these benighted people and were the most intimate with them, and did have the familiarity with the language and the culture, with the goal of like obliteration and used abusive methods to carry out that goal. So there's a way in which this is not just the story of this particular, what one could almost say, freakishly evil scheme, but it fits in with this broader pattern of sort of, you know, like benevolent racism, paternalistic racism. And I think that's a big part of racism in general, that it, you know, some of the great historians of slavery, in my review in The Nation, I mentioned Eugene Genovese and Elizabeth Fox Genovese, problematic faves for Marxist historians for many reasons. But in their writings, they really emphasize that the slave household was a paternalistic household, with the head of the enslavers, the planters, stylizing themselves as the head of the family. You know, the slaves, they're part of our family. And in many cases, you know, like, you know, one thinks of, you know, Thomas Jefferson and Sally Hemings, that was literally the case, that the people who are being enslaved were sometimes also the, I don't want to say romantic, because it's not, I mean, they were in some sort of physical relationship with the enslaved and the enslavers, and that produced children. And so some of the children who are the enslaved children were the children of the enslavers. And so I mean, that model of racism is like racism. It combines racism with domestic abuse. There's racism at the very basic level of family. And so, you know, like as the kids say today, intersexual, right? Like there's the patriarchy and racism go hand in hand.
Well, that's clearly on display in this movie. And, you know, without getting too much into the sort of Sally Hemings slavery paradigm, I mean, obviously, in a situation like that, we're talking about people who are, you know, literally enslaved and unfree and cannot meaningfully consent to the relations they're having, whatever the nuances of those relations may be. There's something inherently violating about it in that context. I didn't mean that as a criticism of you,
No, I want to say, yeah, there's a spectrum. And then, like, I brought up the Sally Hemings thing as the most extreme the thing of this. And then what this movie does is, like, interesting because I'll let you continue.
Yeah.
Like, I think.
Yeah. What I wanted to say is that, so this is a movie in which, as you wrote in your Nation review, domestic abuse is, you know, part of the crime that's being committed here. But what makes this movie so unsettling and nuanced in its way is that although we know that the marriage of Molly Burkhardt, who's incredibly portrayed by Lily Gladstone, and Ernest Burkhardt, the DiCaprio character, although we know that he is being essentially assigned to marry her by Hale, and although we know that, you know, he has a clear mercenary motivation to do so, you know, he maintains pretty much throughout the movie that he actually does love Molly. And we're given some reason to believe, I mean, I feel uncomfortable calling what he, you know, a man who's poisoning his wife and conspiring against and murdering her family. I have a hard time calling that love, but I'll allow that. You know, I mean, Ernest is a simpleton, which is kind of central to DiCaprio's presentation of him. He's a dullard. He's kind of a nothing. And I'll allow that in his kind of moral and intellectual shallowness, he may believe himself to love Molly. He certainly is a genuine affection for and attraction to and connection to her. And crucially, it's reciprocated. And crucially, because Molly is such a fascinating character, and Gladstone captures this so brilliantly, it's reciprocated even though Molly is not stupid. And even though Molly is on some level aware, at the very least, that you know, Ernest wants money, which he doesn't deny, because she's far from the only Osage woman marrying a white man in this milieu. That, you know, her relatives have done the same thing. It's this huge pattern. And, you know, it's to Scorsese's enormous credit, I think, as a storyteller, that he's able to capture this very uncomfortable scenario in which Molly is not compelled to marry Ernest. She does it very voluntarily. She does love him. And she does so even though she's aware of the economic imbalance between them and motives he may have, which he doesn't really deny. And she's aware on some level, which kind of culminates by the end of the movie, as events proceed, that he's also involved in this murderous plot, that it's not just a matter of wanting to marry rich. And she's able to kind of live with a certain degree of denial about that. And the only real lens for understanding how an intelligent person could find themselves in that situation for as long as she does is abuse, relational abuse, domestic marital abuse. I mean, what we are seeing here is an abusive marriage. And what Molly is someone trapped in an abusive marriage that she knows on some level is destroying her and destroying her family and her people. But that's very, very hard to pry herself out of, especially because of all the, you know, structural and societal forces that are reinforcing it, which are profound in this case. But the level of personal denial she has and her eventual triumph over it is incredibly poignant, in part because it you know, forces us to engage with not just the evil that's being inflicted on the Osage, but with the Osage as complicated characters who and individuals who are caught up in you know, very complicated human relations, not least of which is and I think this is not too on the nose, but is a kind of strange attraction to the white men who are plundering them.
Yeah, no, I think that's right. Well, I mean, as I mentioned earlier, there's a kind of, you know, a wave of sort of scholarship on Indigenous people. And one thing that gets emphasized is, you know, obviously, you know, this huge cruelty and even genocide, but also, like, you know, these are peoples that, like, lived next to each other for centuries and did engage in sort of cultural exchange, you know, communication. And you know, like, yeah, there was some level of sort of reciprocal engagement. Yeah, once he's at in other places as well, like, you know, in some of the wars that are existing in the world today, you know, like, you know, in Ukraine and Russia, you know, on one hand, like, you know, obviously great cruelty and imperialism, but there's also a cultural history of Ukraine and Russia that's a more complicated, and also in the Middle East, one has to say, but we won't go there. But
but I think it's fine to briefly go there and just say that Israelis and Palestinians are, you know, have extremely intertwined cultures as a result of this settler colonial encounter that can often, and this is true with Russia and Ukraine too, manifest itself in fights over, you know, food items, for instance, and who really invented them, where there's huge stakes in that question, even though we're talking about foods that, you know, both sides enjoy, and if they were at peace, could enjoy together. And certainly in this movie, I mean, the Osage never had that moment of militarized resistance. They didn't have the numbers or the position to do it, really. They resist in the ways they can, but those are very, very limited. But I think you certainly see this cultural reciprocity, not just in, you know, Hale learning the Osage language, but also in, you know, these wealthy Osage are wearing the fashions of the Roaring Twenties, you know, and going to speakeasies and you know, driving the fanciest new cars and stuff, you know, and their houses, these wonderful suburban houses that some of them have that, you know, are very much in the style of the time. But then they'll decorate them with, you know, traditional Osage handicrafts. Yeah. It's there's something very, to me at least, kind of beautiful about this kind of roaring 20s, wealthy Osage fusion culture that we're introduced to and then see torn to shreds by these, you know, voracious white mobster settlers.
Yeah. Yeah, no, I mean, that point about cultural exchange is so important, and I think it's something that people in a sort of generalized sense don't get from their knowledge of, like, American history. That, I mean, one of the things about, you know, what does one associate with indigenous cultures in the Americas? The horse is certainly one thing, but, you know, the horse came from the old world, right? And it was something that was adopted by the indigenous people and then used brilliantly by them. And so you know, and, you know, like, conversely, a lot of things that one thinks of as, you know, American food, like turkey or whatever, you know, are, like, came from the indigenous cultures. So yeah, I mean, the film does actually, and then this is, like, very typical of Scorsese. He's an amazingly anthropological filmmaker, like very attentive to group dynamics and to the sort of, you know, the way cultures interact. And that's a big part of it. On the point you made about, I mean, it is an uncomfortable thing, the fact that this is a love story as well as a story of, you know, like, domestic abuse and murder. And one thing I want to emphasize is that actually came, this emphasis came from Molly's family herself, that, you know, in the process of, like, you know, working on the script and, you know, conceptualize the movie, Scorsese and the actors, they met with the Osage, and including meeting with one of Molly Burkhart's granddaughters. And the granddaughter, this is something Lily Gladstone mentioned in an interview, the granddaughter said, you know, you have to remember that Ernst and Molly loved each other. And that's an important part of the story. And so, you know, it's...
Should say, by the way, that the book, yes, at least two-thirds of the way through the book, does not emphasize this. The book far more focused on the FBI, mm-hmm, and the it's kind of a detective story almost. It's an investigation of, mm-hmm, of a murder ring, and, you know, the characters of the movie are all present in the book. Their, mm-hmm, stories are there, but it, you know, it is certainly not the story of Ernest and Molly foregrounded. That's a choice that Scorsese made.
This is a story that has come through, like, in interviews, that there was a first draft, which is very close to the book, and was a kind of, like, FBI police procedural.
And DiCaprio, not Jesse Plemons, was supposed to play Tom White.
And so the main character would be the FBI, your proto-FBI investigator who, like, did this, and it's about the formation of the FBI. And, yeah, the plum role of DiCaprio would be the FBI agent. And it was DiCaprio himself who was, like, unhappy with that script and said, you know, there's something missing here, the heart. And then they were talking to the Osage, and there are other books. Lily Gladstone recommended them, and the name doesn't come to mind, but I'll put it in the show notes. There was a novel written by an Osage woman that deals with the relationship between Ernst and Molly, and that was much more of an inspiration in addition to the David Grand book. So there was a shift in the making of the movie away from the FBI story to the domestic abuse story. And in doing so, they started to draw on other sources. They started to draw on what they heard from the Osage themselves and from family stories and from these other written accounts. I haven't read the book. You're two-thirds of the way through. A very well-regarded book, but from everything I've heard and from what you're saying, it is a book about, as the subtitle says, you know, the formation of the FBI, the birth of the FBI.
Yeah, which is part of this movie, to be sure, and maybe worth talking a little bit about, because, well, so one thing that Graham says explicitly, and Scorsese doesn't feel the need to say explicitly, that, again, one thing I really liked about this movie is how many times, in contrast to so much of, I think, popular culture right now, how many times Scorsese could have been on the nose and, mm-hmm, isn't, and trusts audiences to sort of see these nuances for themselves. Grant says explicitly, and I don't fault him for this at all, when he first talks about J. Edgar Hoover, and, you know, who was a bureaucrat, not a cop, and built the FBI basically in order to, you know, build his sort of bureaucratic fortress in the federal government that he would then maintain for decades. Capsule introducing Hoover and his founding of the FBI says, you know, he would go on to commit some of the greatest abuses of power in American history. Now, if you have the most glancing familiarity with 20th century...
Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
American history, the name J. Edgar Hoover conjures up that, you know, point to you. You may not know all the details, but you know he wiretapped MLK or whatever. You know J. Edgar Hoover's not a great guy. You know he spied on the new left. The movie, which mentions Hoover exactly once, as you know, or maybe twice actually, but you know, mentions him in passing. He's not portrayed on screen. And, you know, the agency that we see is called the Bureau of Investigation. Mm-hmm. They haven't called it the FBI yet. But, you know, Scorsese trusts you to know who Hoover is, have some vague, I think, negative association with him, to understand that this thing called the Bureau of Investigation is what's going to become the FBI. He doesn't need to show you that the FBI is actually bad in a lot of ways. Mm-hmm. Well, he does show that they torture confessions out of somebody in this early iteration of them, which, you know, I think audiences aren't particularly inclined to object to because the people they're going after are so monstrous and we just want to see them stopped. But, you know, is in fact a civil liberties abuse. But really, I think where the movie's subtle but existent point of view on the FBI comes in is in that penultimate scene, the radio show taping, which is a totally fascinating scene. In which it's some decades have passed. When do we think that is? The 40s, the 50s?
It's the 40s. Yeah. Wait a minute. I'm trying to. The show's Gangbusters, and that would have been the late 40s, and it would have actually been a show that like Martin Scorsese had listened to. Like he's talked in interviews about listening to these like crime radio shows.
Right. It's basically a true crime podcast. It's basically Serial before Serial.
And I should mention, I mean, we talked about how this story of the Osage, you know, had been forgotten. But actually, I mean, there's sort of waves of knowledge about it. And there was this period in the 20s when it first happened, where it was very much used to bolster the image of the FBI as it was being created, and to say, you know, like this shows what we're necessary, we can do. You have this local crime that no one can solve, we can do it. And then later, Hoover was a master of media manipulation. You know, got Hollywood and others. There's a Hollywood movie in the late 50s that's based on it, but these radio shows. And I'll mention, for listeners who know my interest in comics, Jack Kirby actually did a comic book story in Headline Comics in 1948 based on the Osage murders. Nope. You know, and which had because Kirby drew it, it's a great comic, but it has the sort of standard, and it deals with the racism. I mean, it highlights the racism that was the main motive, but it has the standard thing at the end where it's like, you know, thank you, Mr. Hoover, and thank you, FBI, for doing this and for solving this crime. And then that's exactly what Hoover wanted. He wanted people to be reading comic books, listening to radio shows, and watching movies that like celebrated the FBI. And, you know, as you said, this is okay. It's a bit of a spoiler alert, but that's an incredibly amazing thing at the end where you have first the story of the 20s, then you leap forward, not to the present, but to the 40s. And you have a radio program. And So
I want to talk about that. But first, let me just say, Jeet, have you done one of your trademark Twitter threads on this Jack Kirby?
Oh, I have. Yeah. I'll link to that as well. I do actually have a Twitter thread that talks, you know, Scorsese.
I didn't see it, but it's just like, as soon as you said that, I was like, oh, that's a Jeet Twitter thread right there.
Clearly. Yeah. In fact, Jack Kirby grew up like about 10 or 15 minutes away from where Scorsese did. I mean, obviously, like, there's a 20-year difference. Like, Kirby was born in, like, 1917 and Scorsese in the early 40s. But they were coming out of the same, neighborhoods, basically. Right. So I have a whole discussion of all this. But yes.
The radio show.
Yeah, the radio show. But this actually explains why, like, I don't know if, like, Scorsese remembered anything from the 40s or not, but he would have been very familiar with all the sort of FBI propaganda that the radio show exemplifies. And so, so in some ways he's hearkening back to his own youth, but go on.
Well, so my friends and I who watch movies together have a kind of this running joke. Actually, it's a joke stolen from a Twitter account and I don't remember who it was, but someone tweeted something about the movie Black Panther when that was in theaters and popular, where they were like, I like the movie Black Panther, but, you know, I really think it would have worked better at the end if the Black Panther had King T'Challa or whatever had turned to the camera and said, I'm a communist and the exact same kind of communist you are. And we riff on this a lot. And the joke is basically not necessarily communist, but any type of progressive, you know, quote unquote, woke progressives or whatever, who demand that art not only align with their political perspective, but like explicitly spell it out such that like no idiot could miss the point of what the art is saying. And you know, me and my friends who share that, you know, quote unquote, woke and lefty political perspective, you know, still think there's something to be said for nuance and artistry and subtlety and treating the audience as intelligent people. So that case in point for Scorsese, who I think is wonderful at not doing that, not having the characters turn to the camera and tell us exactly how we're supposed to feel.
I think that's true of like almost all of Scorsese. I will say that there's the infamous ending of The Departed, which has the
rat
is set against the that's a
fun little visual metaphor, but it's still not exactly what I'm talking about.
He's not exactly like, saying which form of communism
this is,
but yes.
No, this is a movie where, like, you know, characters could turn to us at the end and spell out the exact messages. And I think he shows admirable restraint in that while really capturing as few movies have just how violent and evil and sinister white supremacy and colonialism and patriarchy are. All of that is in the text. None of it screams at us. And in particular on this FBI point, as captured in the radio show, because I can imagine, I think, a very shallow reading of the movie as it relates to the FBI. I'm going to say this in the voice of a straw man critic that I'm making up, so stipulated. But this shallow straw man critic might look at the movie and they might say, okay, like, you know, clearly Ernest and Hale are bad guys, but the FBI, as portrayed by the movie, are great, right? Like Jesse Plemons comes in as a white knight, and he stops these local gangsters, and he puts them in jail, maybe not for long enough, but he does, and he ends the killing spree. And then, you know, Marty Scorsese comes 20 years later on this fun radio show, and he tells us, you know, that it's sad how the Osage murders never got their real due. And then we cut to the final shot of today's Osage in formation. And, you know, it's an uplifting story about how in the end America did the right thing. I would find that a terribly shallow, reductive, missing the point reading. And maybe I just made it up. Maybe there's no one who read it that way. But no, I suspect
there are definitely people out there. I've seen it who have said, well, this is a white savior movie. Yeah, even the FBI's agent.
It sounds like the first draft might have been. It sounds like the first draft might have veered too closely for that.
Yeah, yeah. But, no, I mean, what do you say that the note that the FBI agent, who's like is a heroic figure in the book and in the movie, his name is Tom White, isn't it? Or
Tom White, which is so that's real, but that's such a like
that's real. Yeah, I know, but it's absolutely, I totally agree. I mean, there's a sort of idea that some people, you know, I think an incredibly superficial reading of the movie is it's a white savior movie, but it absolutely isn't.
Let me give the alternative critical read of what I think is being done with the FBI, and especially in that radio show scene, you know, where, again, if Scorsese were a worse filmmaker, someone could have turned to the camera and made this more explicit than it actually is. But it's there. I believe it's there, and I believe it's deliberate. First of all, you know, we are made clear, if nothing else, about this radio show that it's sponsored by Hoover, who I think Scorsese assumes audiences have a generally sinister connotation with, and Lucky Strike cigarettes that's sponsoring it, which are, you know, literally deadly and would not be allowed to advertise today. But, you know, it's the late 1940s and cigarettes are totally mainstream and advertised for everything. And that's not just a kind of a quaint, oh, we're in the 40s historical detail. It's a reminder that, you know, this is everything we're seeing with this radio show scene is commercially sponsored FBI propaganda. That's what it
is. Within capitalism.
Capitalism. Everyone on the stage is white. Everyone in the audience is white, right? The Osage are not here to tell their own story. In fact, there are no black people there either, because this is being done in a deeply segregated mid-century America. The white people who are telling the story are doing so with these kind of like funny, quaint, you know, comic side effects and exaggerated dialogue that, you know, again, you could superficially read as, oh, this is Marty's nostalgia for, you know, the 40s and his childhood or whatever, and the golden age of radio. But no, it's all after this brutal story we've just been through, incredibly trivializing. It's turned that into entertainment. It's turned it into sanitized, you know, FBI and Lucky Strike sponsored entertainment by white entertainers for white audiences, in which the whole thing is a kind of a caper. And in putting himself on stage, which I think some people have called indulgent, Marty is in fact implicating himself in that. Mm-hmm. He's showing how he himself is part of how American tragedies are turned into entertainment for white people, which, you know, if you look at the way some of his other movies have been received, like The Wolf of Wall Street, a movie where, you know, huge numbers of people miss the point. I mean, it's a savage portrayal of Wall Street culture. And there are people who read it as a, you know, a celebration of how fun it is to be Jordan Belfort, because he never turns to the camera and says, actually, Jordan Belfort is a really bad man. He just shows you again and again how that's the case. And similarly, I think in this movie, yeah, Marty is indicting himself. He's indicting, you know, himself as a white man, as an entertainer, as an entertainer who would deign to tell the story, while also, you know, trying to show he's aware of that and has tried to do better than that for the, you know, 99% of the movie. And, you know, I think he's also indicting to a certain extent the present day true crime podcast audience that also likes terrible human stories turned into their kind of light entertainment, which, you know, I suspect many people listening to this have, you know, enjoyed Serial, for instance, as I did.
Yeah.
But, you know, there's something inherently sick about that, even when it's done pretty well and pretty sensitively. And I think he's nodding to that as well.
Yeah, no. I think that's absolutely right. I mean, I think there has always been this critique that his films are sort of glorifying gangsters. And I just, like, you know, on one level, I never understood it, because, I mean, even in something like Goodfellas, which, like, you know, it does, like, the first half of the movie does show you, like, you know, like the thrill of being a gangster and the thrill of, like, you know, just being able to push people around and get everything you want. But, like, you know, like, you, even at that first half, like, you also see these guys are real thugs and goons, and it's a terrifying world because they could turn on you at any time. And certainly by the end of that movie, you know, like, everything that, like, why you would not want to be a gangster, I think, is there, like, in pretty explicit terms. So I was like, well, that's a very superficial reading. But having said that, there are actual people out there who you meet who, like, you know, like, think of Henry Hill and Tommy, played by Joe Pesci in the movie, as, you know, like, you know, characters they want to emulate. And that's always the problem with, like, you know, these powerful depictions of evil. You know, you get bad, but I, you know, the notorious bad fans that, and
I have to think, by the way, that this particular movie, even if it could be misread as ultimately, you know, too sympathetic to the FBI, other than that, I think is almost bad fan proof. It's almost impossible for me to imagine anybody aspiring to be Hale or Ernest. They are so loathsome. Even though they are played by, you know, beloved Hollywood leading men, even though they're brilliant performances and we get a lot of insight into, like, how they rationalize themselves, I just can't. There's no equivalent in this movie to the famous Coppa tracking shot in Goodfellas, you know, where they go through the VIP entrance into this club and the music is playing and it's just like, oh, this is glamorous. I totally get why someone would want to be a gangster. There's nothing like that here. Obviously, anyone can understand the appeal of stealing a fortune worth tens or hundreds of millions of dollars. But even the way these white mobsters spend their money isn't particularly appealing. I think he leans hard on how degraded they are, in particular in the scene where Hale spanks Ernest in the Masonic Lodge.
Yeah.
I just can't imagine it's any modern audience wanting that.
No, it's not a glamorous criminal. Actually, I think both The Irishman and in this movie are both kind of him trying to address that complaint about his work, and you know, like showing like a sort of totally, you know, unglamorous view of the criminal world. I mean, I felt in The Irishman as well, like there's the way that you could look at that character and think like, I want to be that, you know, this utterly damned soul who's alienated his family, and the same here. Yes.
Yeah. They don't get Margot Robbie either. And, you know,
yeah, no. Having said so, I do think that, I mean, it's sort of, he's returning to this sort of thematics of the criminal gang. And I like I said, I do think that there's like some awareness on, you know, maybe he's on his part of like trying to address the critique. But I want to emphasize as well, like as I did at the beginning, there's stuff here that is like very much tied to Scorsese's whole career. And the two big thematics I see, or maybe the three big thematics, are, and they're all intertwined, the sort of male abuser, the domestic abuse, the male that's a terrible boyfriend. There's very few Scorsese characters that you would be happy to see your daughter or your female friends date. Like, these are not good guys ever. This goes back like to the very beginning of his filmography, you know, like a sort of almost student film he made in 1967, Who's That Knocking at My Door, where Harvey Keitel plays a guy named JR, who, you know, falls in love with like this wonderful arty girl, but then, you know, it comes out in the relationship that she had been raped before, and then he like, you know, has that, you know, horrific sexist reaction, like, you know, you're tarnished goods, and like, you know, like, you know, doesn't want any part of her, and then later tries to get back to her by saying like, I'm willing to like, you know, overlook your rape, like as if, you know, this is like, you know, like, and so right from the start, this is 1967, you know, like a huge awareness of what, you know, we now call toxic masculinity. And that's been a big thematic. The lesser thematic, but I think it's always been in there, his work, is an awareness of the way that racism structures American society. And the third thematic, which I think links the two of them, is the group. The sort of, you know, the conspiratorial group that like looks after its own and is organized along patriarchal and racist lines. Yeah. You know, famously the mafia in many movies, but not just the mafia. I mean, once, I think you wanted to make a point about the Age of Innocence.
I did. So I literally watched Age of Innocence, Marty's 1993 adaptation of it, for the first time last night. Wonderful movie. Highly recommend. And, you know, I have not read the Edith Wharton novel, although I had the, you know, vague familiarity with its premise. But you know, this is obviously, or maybe not obviously, depending on who you are, a story about WASP high society in late 19th century New York. And it's kind of a romantic triangle. And it's full of, you know, there's no murders in it. There's not really crime per se. It's you know, it's a high society drama. But it's gut-wrenching, because what it captures so well, and what I'm guessing the novel also captures well, my sense is it's a very faithful adaptation, is how these WASP elite circles are actually structured very much like a mafia, with all kinds of rules and omerta and codes that have to be observed, and ways that order is maintained and transgressions are punished or disappeared. Transgressors are disappeared. And, you know, it's incredibly subtle how the movie captures this, because for much of its run, the story you think you're getting is the story of Daniel Day-Lewis's character, Newland Archer, and Michelle Pfeiffer's character, you know, estranged from her abusive marriage socialite, and he's engaged to Winona Ryder's character, May, who is her cousin, and who is kind of played as a naive. And meanwhile, Newland and Olenska played as kind of savvy and worldly, and like they're the only two people who see through all the like mundane conventions of the society around them, and they have a real bond and love and lust for each other, because they can talk about those things in an honest way that no one else around them can. And you watch most of the movie and you think, okay, this is like a portrait of that society and of a, you know, forbidden love affair happening between the only two people who see through it. But if I may spoil this century-old novel and 30-year-old movie, in the final acts of the movie, something really profound and, you know, a kind of a gut punch happens, where what you realize is May, the naive to whom is engaged and eventually married, is much less naive than she seems. Mm-hmm. And in fact, all of the high society gossips around them have been, you know, have kind of silently clocked their affair for a while now and are totally aware of it and manipulate things such that those two are permanently separated by an ocean. Newland is locked into his marriage with May forever and is a dutiful husband and father for the rest of his days. And no one ever speaks of it. No one, you know, there's no condemnation, no accusation. Newland and Olenska both get to be rich and preserve their respectability, but they don't get each other, which is the ultimate torment for them. And you see how this society, in its silent, brilliant ways, has actually outfoxed them completely, destroyed their love, trapped them, because they're, you know, the only way they could actually escape together would be to accept social disgrace and part with their fortunes, which they would never do. And you realize that the story you've been following the whole time is kind of the inverse, that these two people are kind of pathetic and totally entrapped by this very powerful mob-like society that has total control over their lives. It's an incredible story. And, you know, for something that I'm sure seems like a literary chick flick to the undiscerning viewer, you know, it's a mafia story. It's perfectly Scorsese.
No, that's absolutely right. Yeah, yeah. The sort of society as a conspiracy and how hard won truth actually is, and the revelation that recasts everything that you've seen before. I mean, these are all, you know, kind of great things that he does. So I mean, I think we've sort of covered everything, except that I did want to say one final thing about the dealing with the racism. You know, like, this is something I don't think has been noticed enough, that he has always kind of acknowledged, or not acknowledged, but even been very aware and very sensitive to racism and dealt with racism, you know, with that sort of subtlety that you praised before. In Taxi Driver, if you watch it closely, you'll notice it's a very subtle thing. But whenever, like, Travis Bickle, played by Robert De Niro, is in a room with a black person, he just visibly tenses up, just like ever so slightly. And in that movie, Scorsese himself has a kind of cameo appearance as this, you know, horrific husband who wants to kill his wife because she's having an affair with a black man. And then that, I think that scene is supposed to shed light on Travis Bickle's whole psychology. But in many of the other movies, it's never, in I think previous movies, it's never been like a foregrounded thing, but it's been in the background. If you watch Goodfellas, the Tommy character, the way he kind of like freaks out when his girlfriend suggests that Sammy Davis Jr. is attractive is a very interesting moment. As is the moment where, like, you know, the Goodfellas, they kind of like rob a truck, but they go in and say, like, oh, we saw two black guys do it, right? Yeah. And actually also the Samuel L. Jackson character in that movie, who is kind of part of the gang, but not quite part of the gang, is kind of like, you know, the Scorsese is just like, has been, I think, like, remarkably observant and subtle about how race plays itself out. But I until this movie, it's never been at the foreground. I think one thing the movie does is it takes these, like, you know, his observational skills about racism, but really, like, brings it to the foreground and then links it up with these other thematic concerns about domestic abuse and about the conspiratorial criminal gangs that rule society. The gangsters as, yeah.
I mean, the other Scorsese movie I watched for the first time recently, and it's a recent movie of his, that sort of fits into this is Silence, which I thought was brilliant, which is his movie about Portuguese priests in, I think, 16th century Japan, who are there to, you know, convert some large population of Japanese to Christianity. They have, to Catholicism, but the Tokugawa shogunate, as it's consolidating, is punishing Christianity by death and, you know, threatening and torturing whole communities into recanting. And these missionaries are basically alone in Japan. They don't have, you know, an imperial military apparatus behind them at this stage, which means that although we are aware that we, as well-informed, you know, audiences are aware that what they're doing is a kind of, you know, they're functioning as agents of Western imperialism, trying to, you know, mm-hmm. break into a kind of a closed foreign society. But, you know, Scorsese is able to present both Japanese Buddhist society and these Catholic priests very empathetically and very much as kind of products of systems that are just antagonistic to each other, you know, that, mm-hmm. that essentially have to clash. And he doesn't do this in a heavy-handed way. The point of silence, I don't think, is, you know, Westerners never should have tried to bring Christianity to Japan, nor do I think it's Westerners should have brought Christianity to Japan, and it would be good if the Japanese were all Catholic right now. But rather, I think how these... I think he pays real respect to the two cultures that are clashing, and I think he pays real respect to the kind of structures of power, in particular in Japan itself, that essentially necessitate the horrible human suffering that results from this encounter. And that's just... I think a very neat trick to pull off that so many filmmakers are so far from being able to do.
Yeah, no, I think that's right. And it absolutely ties in with the current movie. And then since you mentioned silence, maybe the other theme or thematic to think about is religion and faith and the sacred in the broad sense. I mean, obviously, you know, Scorsese grew up being a Catholic, had a period where he was thought about becoming a priest, didn't have the vocation, but it is, you know, remains very interested in faith in all its forms. And there's two ways that the faith plays out in the movie. One is with the Osage and with the sort of, you know, the traditions, and which I think I brought very meaningfully to life about their conception of the afterlife. But the other is like the Osage in the movie, you know, are Catholic converts, although they have a mixture of, as many indigenous people do, their Catholicism is tinged with their own native spirituality. And there's this whole issue of like sort of like forgiveness. And I think one of the interesting things the movie does is, you know, tries to give, you know, like as much context or understanding of like very horrible actions, you know, which in the end are still condemned. But I think that the attention to actually like trying to understand why evil people do what they do and how they justify evil to themselves, to me, that seems like a very religious project as much as a narrative project. It does seem like, and I think that there's sort of like the Irishman as well. Like in some ways, it to me is like the interesting theme of the movie is, you know, Frank Sheeran is given like many, many chances for some turning away from evil or from turning away from the life that he had lived, and he can never do it. And the end, he's left with a kind of like, you know, the silence of God and is an utterly damned soul. And that's a very powerful thing, which I don't think very many filmmakers have, that sense of, you know, the sacred and the spiritual and, you know, like what are the limits of forgiveness?
Yeah. I mean, and this is the last thing I'll say, but as a totally atheistic Jew who has a kind of low-level visceral contempt for organized religion and is certainly not a Catholic, it is, I felt this above all watching Silence, but it's true in this in Killers too and in other movies he's made. It is a real testament to Scorsese's skill that he takes faith so seriously that I take it seriously. Yeah. Like the way he captures faith on screen and the logics of faith on screen, I find myself like weirdly able to understand where these priests are coming from, even though their mission of saving souls is completely alien to me. And where the Japanese Buddhists who want to shut them down and force them to recant, where they're coming from too. And I think that just speaks to Scorsese's general talent at taking people, societies, and their deep motivations completely seriously in everything he does.
Yeah, no, absolutely, absolutely. Yeah, you know, just as you can tell, yeah, I think we're both two thumbs up, you know, like in the sort of Siskel and Ebert language. It is a really, you know, I mean, less facetiously, it's an incredibly great and powerful film, which I hope people will go see.
I couldn't agree more.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.